Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. I'm really delighted to have Father David McCallum as our guest. David is a Jesuit priest. He's the executive director of the Discerning Leadership Program, which is a formation program for senior Vatican administrators and others. The headquarters is in Rome. And the idea of the program and his work at the moment he's focusing on is to advance a synodal church. David, you're really welcome to Edgy Ideas. Can we begin by asking how you are? How are things in Rome?
Thanks, Simon. Things are good in Rome, if I'm not mistaken. I'm actually in Milan at the moment doing a language study course to get ready for our course in Italian this summer. But no, things in Italy seem to be on the good side of things in terms of COVID, and it's certainly nice and bright here. So yeah, great to be with you.
How long have you been in Italy? You moved from the US, is that right?
Yeah, I moved a year and a half ago, and I used to commute here regularly for work, but this is the first year and a half of a new assignment.
Great. So we're going to explore that assignment. You've been in touch with me, and we've been doing a bit of work together on this idea of a synodal church. Would you like to share what a synodal church is to our audience?
You know, what it is a work in progress. Yeah. So, you know, several years ago, Pope Francis had announced the idea that we would have a large, in fact, probably historically large gathering of the church, the Catholic Church, to explore a new way of being, but in a sense to really go back to the very beginnings of the church shortly after the experience of whatever Pentecost the early disciples and their followers experienced, which involved a really interesting way of making sense of their path as Christians. It was one that was discerned in many ways in a collective manner, and it involved decision-making with people who had formal roles of authority and consultation with others. And this earliest form of Christian governance, in a sense, is something that Pope Francis is trying to call us back to, but also it involves, as you can imagine, with a church of, you know, more than a billion Catholics, a lot of complexity that early church didn't have. And so since Vatican II, in the 60s, when the notion of opening the church to the modern world and encouraging collegiality amongst bishops, who were often really accustomed to working as their own chiefs, this call to synodality is really a call, okay, to hearken back to our earliest DNA and also to take the work of Vatican II forward. So let's see if I can give you a little bit more specificity. You know that most people, when they think of the Catholic Church, they think of a hierarchy that's something like a pyramid, you know, and roughly you've got the parish priests and the people in the pews at the bottom of that pyramid, then some kind of ambiguous hierarchy of bishops and archbishops and cardinals, and then the Pope at the top. What Pope Francis is really looking to do is, in a sense, not just invert the pyramid, but really put servant leadership at the heart of this empowerment of the laity to take up their roles as really the heart of the church. Mm-hmm. And that the function of priests, of bishops, of archbishops and cardinals is to give capacity to those lay people to participate fully in the mission of the church and also to take up that mission in their own roles, right, in their own daily lives. This is, well, it's revolutionary in some ways because we know that the church often gets lost in a focus on the reputation and the importance and the authority of priests, nuns or religious. But what Pope Francis really wants to do is shift the attention. And it involves a challenge to clericalism and to the way that bureaucracy can often be corrupted by clericalism.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really interesting, and I do think it's radical. I mean, it's why when you invited me to join you to help think about this using my eco-leadership ideas, it really attracted me because it does seem that it's very radical in the sense that, I mean, like you say, people still think of top-down change, and it comes from the Pope to the bishops to the priests and down the line and right at the bottom of that pile are the parishioners. But this is a thing about leadership from the edge, isn't it? It brings leadership from the edge into this. It brings leadership from women, from lay people, from all walks of life into the heart of the church. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. I think that there are several really amazing examples fairly recently. For instance, many of your listeners may have heard at least of the Synod on the Amazon. The intention of Pope Francis was that the situation of the church in the Amazon is quite serious. There's very few ordained priests to serve, thousands and thousands of people in that region. And not only that, but the biosphere of the Amazon is one of the key biospheres on the planet. His commitment to an integral ecology means really addressing the questions of the bio sort of social sort of world there in the Amazon. And the idea was to bring the Amazon, the periphery, as he would say, to the center. Mm-hmm. And that involved bringing indigenous people and church leaders of tremendously diverse backgrounds right to Rome for a month-long gathering. And that notion, as you say, of bringing the periphery to the center, it completely challenges the in-the-bubble kind of view that people have working in the center administration and enriches people's perspectives with that diversity, also complicating, you know, how we see things in the best sense. So this way of shifting attention, of diversifying points of view, of creating spaces where a kind of encounter and conversation is happening that's not conventional, but enriched by alterity is really critical.
Yeah, yeah. And what would you say drove the change? You talked about Vatican II and the idea about bringing the church into the modern world. There's the environmental piece, which you've just discussed. Is some of it driven by necessity that like in the West, it's difficult to recruit priests anymore to get enough priests? Or is it really driven by this idea that it will be a kind of much richer church by engaging the laity?
Well, to be honest with you, Simon, I think it's much bigger than the church. And I'd like to try this idea out on you. I don't think I'm original here, but I think that we're going through such an epical change within our experience of civilization today. And Pope Francis has described it not just as an era of change, but a change of eras. Mm-hmm. So we might, you know, look at it from a sort of political, social point of view, a philosophical point of view. Postmodernism has kind of run its course. The deconstructive move is really a dead end in so many ways. And there's not a lot of clarity about what is yet to emerge. So we stand in this threshold, and there's a tremendous amount of anxiety as the traditional reference points have kind of been lost, the authority of institutions, the kind of integrity and the public trust in figures and authority, which has been on the wane for some time. And the ideas that have been really shaping our civilization in the West are now being shaken. So tremendous amounts of uncertainty and a lot of a sense of ambiguity. But in the face of all that, if I'm not mistaken, Pope Francis is taking stock of this and seeing that this is a kind of unfreezing, right, of a certain way of being in the world and certainly a way of being church and of taking up authority. And when we meet that with the sense of the church's resources, tradition, and mission, well, there's this sort of upswelling of some kind of direction. We want to serve the common good. We want to make sure that we're serving a kind of well-being for the greater whole, including the earth. There has to be in that mix a sense of including incredibly diverse perspectives. The church doesn't exist in a bubble. It's actually incredibly interpenetrating with so many other social realities, right? And so The question I think he's raising is, how can we enter into a massive process of stock-taking and listening through real encounter and dialogue with people who have different experiences? As we know, in a tremendously polarized society and a polarized church, this is not so easy. And then on the basis of that listening, to really discern, as we would say in Catholic speak, what is the Holy Spirit calling the church to in this new millennium, in this new era? And that discernment process is what he's inviting the church to over the course of 2 years, a formal process. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's really going to be a generational project. And I think of that in two senses. It'll take a generation or more for this this shift to really be consolidated. And then it's also going to be generative. Something new will be born out of this process. So it's exciting. It's uncertain. It's filled with the need for us to sort out a lot as we go. So we can't predict. That makes a lot of people very anxious. So,
of course. Yeah, no, that's interesting. And it does align. I mean, I've just founded this Ecoleadership Institute, and it works in public sector. We work in manufacturing sector. We work in banks. We work in different organizations, not-for-profits. And everywhere we look, it's like this world is being disrupted. There's technological disruption, there's environmental disruption, and there's social disruption. And it's not a question of like, okay, so now we need to do this. It's now a space is opening. What will we do?
Yes.
And it's very much about you know, Ecoleadership. It's really, again, leadership from the edge. It's really about developing potential within places where traditionally we don't think there is potential. You know, you're a follower, you're at the edge, you're at the bottom of the pile, you know, listening to these voices, trying to discover where leadership is in unexpected places. I'm always saying to people, like, you know, look in unexpected places. If you look for leadership just at the top, you'll find it at the top. But look in unexpected places, listen to kind of different voices, and you'll start to see and feel and be led in new ways. And it's a similar process you're describing, I think.
You bet. I think that the disruption of the status quo and the upset of convention, right, is actually the releasing of a tremendous amount of potential. Yeah. And, you know, in the face of that, many people, I think, will try to control and revert to what's familiar. But for those who have the courage and the willingness to kind of be in that vulnerable unknown together, the experience is a bit like an artist shaping the resources into some kind of new piece, right? And there's a field of potential to be shaped. So one of the things that I find really exciting about this work, and specifically the focus on leaders and a distributed notion of leadership, is that every person, right, has some gift to offer. If the space is created and a leader who's kind of facilitating or holding that space is wise about it and creates the conditions for people to really feel trust and feel the invitation to share what they have to offer. It's a little bit like the multiplication of the loaves and fishes, right? Yeah, there's a generativity to what happens in organizations and teams and spaces like that. Pope Francis likes to describe it as an overflow. And I think of it in terms of the natural phenomenon of emergence. Mm-hmm. So when you have an experience of emergence, say like a murmuration of starlings, right? Yeah. There's something that happens in that incredibly sophisticated biological social dance that is beyond predictability. And there's a dynamism and a kind of interactivity that's so profound. Of course, there's no guiding hand for that. There's a kind of way in which the whole is operating as more than the sum of the parts. And mm-hmm. and I think it's just a really exciting prospect right now for how to shift the mental models of leaders to let go of that need or the tendency to absorb the projection of heroic leadership.
Yeah.
To exercise a little bit of restraint, and even if one has a great vision, not to presume that it's anything but a partial view.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's there's a radical fundamental shift needs to take place in how people conceptualize leadership. I mean, some people say we should get rid of the word, and we should. Henry Mintzberg says let's go to communityship. But I think leadership is important. I think leadership will always be there. And yet I don't see it as a fixed thing. I was just sharing with you a group relations conference I'm directing at the moment. And we're staff members and as holding roles. We're not holding on to position power in the same way. So we're moving between roles. We're moving between membership and leadership roles. And I see leadership always like that. Even if you're a chief executive, at times you're taking up followership roles. You need experts around you. You need support around you. You need different people to take leads at different times. And leadership is a fluid thing, and it moves between followership and leadership. And it's a dance. And it's the idea that we kind of companies, you know, they have a competency training plan where we take all the leaders from the Catholic Church, we put them through this training. They need to be kind of humble. They need to be this. They need to be charismatic. They need to be this and this and this. It's like it puts all the power into the individual, and it's all kind of a top-down one-way street, and leadership just doesn't work like that. Leadership is this kind of fluid relational thing which kind of moves between people, and it's about, for me, it's about creating spaces. It's about really moving from dependency culture to interdependency culture. This is what I think is really at the heart of the work you're doing. It's like, you know, how do you shift from a dependency culture where you have the priest, you have this kind of hierarchy, and it comes down, and you have a dependent laity, into how can we be interdependent?
You bet. There's so many intersections to sort through in the process, right? Because, for instance, theologically, we have this beautiful understanding of the people of God, so that all those who are baptized have equal dignity. In fact, all created persons have the same dignity. And at the same time, we have different roles, and the roles are intended to be complementary and interdependent. And unfortunately, one of the abuses that emerges with a kind of clerical culture is, you know, this sense of the superiority of those who have ordination. It goes back, no doubt, to our earliest human histories, but certainly the Roman Empire had something to do with how the rigidity of roles became part of the church's culture. And the kind of fluidity that you're describing demands a certain amount of maturity to manage. The prudential judgment to know when to take up one's role and when to put it down, how to collaborate, when to suboptimize your ego's sort of needs and really haul the wood and the water like everybody else, and then when to, because of your perspective or one's expertise or point of view, to offer a perspective, to give vision and direction. I mean, it really does involve such a kind of inner discernment, we would call it. And that, I think, is what requires a bit of formation and practice. And it's not like a course you go through and get it down. It's something that you have to just continue to do day after day after day to really, I think, feel like it becomes an art.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, this idea of leadership formation, I was, when I wrote my leadership book, the first edition, I was sat in a Camaldolese monastery in California. I was
Big Sur.
At a Big Sur down there. Have you been?
Yes, it's beautiful. Yeah,
just love, the most amazing place. I mean, you look over the Pacific Ocean, it's absolutely astonishing place. And I just fell in love. I was actually just, I stumbled on it by driving past. I saw this signpost saying Hermitage. And I thought, that looks interesting. And I camped outside and they invited me in. And I spent a week with the monks there. And I was just completing my book. And I just got it really. It's like, you know, you don't teach monks monk skills. Monks only kind of become monks through formation. It's a spiritual formation. And it was a work, it was a prayer, it was the liturgies, it was the pattern. And I thought, this is exactly what leadership is. You don't go on a course and learn leadership at an MBA. You can get some hints, you can get some help, but it's a process of formation. It's about kind of how you live your life, how you are mentored, your spiritual direction, your experiences of making mistakes, your experiences of learning from others, this whole kind of process. And I think it's absolutely vital that this is what I work with in organizations as well. I say, you know, we have to get back this idea of formation. This is like absolutely crucial, and it comes from the monastic kind of traditions.
Yeah, yeah. There's a sense that there's a kind of osmotic process, right? Mm-hmm. And you catch things more than you're taught them. And if you're really catching things well, then you're also able to transmit them to others. I appreciate in the Eastern traditions this expression transmission,
yeah,
because it really does communicate how the most essential learnings, the wisdom in life, are often, they're happening at frequencies and in manners and channels that are certainly not happening in conventional spaces, which is why, to your point, we really emphasize accompaniment, that, yeah. You know, it's one thing to create modules and sessions where you have inputs and frameworks and things like that. They're so helpful. But in order to really give space for transformation, for the unlearning, for instance, of things that have been miseducative for us,
yeah,
and to let those things go, to widen our perspectives, to introduce complexity, to allow our equilibrium to be disturbed in ways that really help us to grow more, I'd say, more agile with time and less fixed and rigid. This really is a different kind of process. And my own background is looking at the field of transformative learning in adults, mm-hmm, and the relationship to adult development. I think these times are really imposing on us such incredible challenges, such incredible pressures, that these supportive spaces, like a good holding environment, are critical. Yeah. And an accompaniment of people through coaching, through spiritual direction, through psychiatric and psychological counseling, they're so important these days.
They are. I mean, an idea I work with a lot, you'll be familiar with, is the idea of containment. It's a psychoanalytic kind of idea. In Tavistock, they talked about maternal containment, and I wrote about paternal containment, and kind of, which is really like getting the idea that you need some clear structures around you and some clarity around you, and you also need like emotional containment. But in the past, in the group relations world, we've drawn on BART, boundaries, authority, role, and task. And in the church, you draw on very clear roles, and the structures are kind of quite rigid. And that gives you kind of a containment, and it gives you kind of a regression and a dependency. And the question for me in my work now is, how do we contain when we don't have those very fixed roles? So how can we do it? And it's like you say, it's through accompaniment, it's through, we do a lot of coaching, we do mentorship, we do peer-to-peer work. This experimental group relations event I'm running at the moment, people are starting to talk about how the network contains people, how peer-to-peer connections are containing people. And I think this is part of the emergent work. I'm not pretending we found the answers, but this is like one of the big questions, I think, about how we can put containment into a situation so that people don't get frightened and anxious, and flip back into controller leadership or authoritarian kind of leadership models and dependency models. You know, you see outside there in the world in politics, when people get anxious and they feel that displaced, they turn to kind of nationalist politics and things. You know, it's like turning to authoritarian regimes. And so we need to really find ways to contain and allow this to happen where people don't get just feel lost and filled with anxiety.
You know, I think you've got your finger on something so essential, obviously. And I think there's a temptation to make it more complicated than it has to be. Mm-hmm. You know, when I look at some of the most successful examples, at least they're not perfect. They're filled with, you know, complexities and conflicts. But some of the most exciting, inventive examples of groups doing new things in the church happened because people gathered as friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can talk about scale and all that till we're blue in the face and lose the spirit of, I think, the essential relationships, which have to involve trust, we know, and we know that that's a precious thing these days and not easy to rebuild in many of these institutions, especially, for instance, the church where it's been so abused. And yet, friendship and this essential building block for collaboration, I think we've overlooked it somehow, as if it has to be something more formalized. But friendships help us to accomplish extraordinary things. Mm-hmm. And as you say, when we create communities of practice, when we create networks, it is the quality of relationships that is the bedrock and the sort of the medium through which these things work or don't work. And without that kind of, we have to admit, ephemeral kind of quality, then these things are just static structures. They don't generate anything. So I want to put a little plug in for the importance of a friendship as an essential feature and support for that kind of containment that you're talking about.
Yeah, and you're talking to a member of the Society of Friends. So it's, you know, as Quakers, you know, friendship is at the heart of their church, and it's been around for over 400 years, and it's managed without kind of hierarchies, and it's not been without problems. It's kind of sometimes it's kind of got very rigid and stuck in certain ways. It's not like an ideal church in any way, but it is an example of kind of working without hierarchy in the same way as some of the other churches. Some of the possibilities, and it puts friendship at the heart of it. The Society of Friends is about friendship and about sharing and about taking up roles when you can do. I like that about the Camarde Lys as well, the monks, that they seem to have three ways of operating in one monastery, and it's sometimes you might feel like you needed to be in more solitary space. Sometimes you needed to just sit and listen to God, you know, just spend a lot of time in that place. Other times you felt like you could give service. So you'd go and you'd do spiritual direction and you'd help visitors and then the retreat house and stuff. And other times you were just part of the community doing the work. And I thought that idea I took away, and I thought that actually applies to life outside the monastery as well. You know, we need time on our own. We need time to listen to our charism, to discover our charism, to discover our special gifts. We need to kind of listen and be prepared to listen. Other times we need to be active out there doing things for the community and giving service. And I think kind of moving between these spaces is part of this work as well.
Yeah, there's a kind of quality of mutuality, which you're describing, which involves a respect and an allowing for the other person to be, as well as a kind of sense that this is the expectation we have for our own need for space and autonomy and agency. So you're part of the Society of Friends, I'm part of the Society of Jesus, but we call ourselves companions of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And that sense of bread breaking, that sense of intimate familiarity. Now, I know this is very tricky when we're talking about a church where boundary violations has been kind of one of the critical shadows. at the same time, moving forward, the way to heal those breaches is not to only go for rigid standards, policies, and procedures to protect people. There has to be a rebuilding, I think, of essential human relations. And I think a maturing of those relations so that there's a higher consciousness, there's a sense of a sort of spirit of mutual concern and regard. I know I'm not saying anything new here, but I think that we're at a time in our history where the scale of organizations and corporations have become so big, so anonymous, that there's a long, I think, that we have in our workplaces, for instance, in our institutions, to have a more human experience. And I think my friend Frederic Laloux's work really points in that direction. There's a sense in which people want to transform their working spaces, their mission-oriented sort of organizations in a direction that's got a human scale.
Yeah, no, I think there's a huge desire for that connection, that connectivity, that deeper experience. And one of the things I've learned myself, I mean, I took up a leadership role a few years ago in a not-for-profit. I was a president of ISBSO, and it's an international society working with psychoanalysis and organizations. And it was just very interesting. I mean, you had a very traditional role in the sense, you know, and you've got all the projections, good and bad, and thrown at you and stuff, and work with them. But actually, I worked with a great team. I mean, I just loved the board I was working with. And it was just such a pleasure to kind of distribute leadership. It was such a pleasure for people when they went off and they did some fantastic work, you know. And each day I kind of, when we had meetings, we used to inherit a system where you'd wake at 7, you'd have breakfast meetings, and you work through right to 7 and 8 at night. And then you kind of have drinks together. And it was like it's stuck in a hotel, and I'm like, not doing it. Like, you know, I can't do that. Personally, it's not my style. So we take 2 hours off in the afternoon and then we walk.
Yeah.
And it was that space in between, that liminal space where you walk, you create friendship, you kind of relax, you kind of got to know each other a bit more. And the amount of work we did during that period was phenomenal by making that spaces, by allowing that friendship to emerge, by creating those bonds. Very, very powerful learning for me, and just the enjoyment of it. Like, you know, the pleasure of actually allowing others to take leadership, the pleasure of kind of becoming friends with your colleagues and doing that work was a real joy.
I think it's one of the great joys of life to do meaningful work with people you love to be with. I mean, what gets better than that? and I am also so blessed to have a team of people who are extremely diverse. I mean, my little team, which works with me directly in the program, is a little powerhouse. But then we have these faculty coming from different institutions. And in a sense, we exist in between spaces. We're not part of a center or an institute, but we have a kind of institutional footing that also gives us great freedom. And it's navigating the spaces in between these institutions and working in this collaborative way with people that I think has allowed us to do something that we don't see anybody else doing. We've got a niche that we've begun to occupy. And it's like a little microclimate, right? Thinking from that biological metaphor. I really think that part of leadership today is looking for those niches where we have very distinct gifts to offer for the need that our needs are out there. And then how do we assemble, you know, people who can occupy that niche with us to complement our strengths or weaknesses? How do we accompany each other in our vulnerabilities? Because I have to admit, this kind of work involves lots of humility and working outside of our comfort zones. Yeah. So, you know, being able to do that with a certain amount of maturity, self-awareness, the ability to communicate how you are with the others you're with, these are really critical skills.
Yeah, and it's more than skills. It's like a way of being in the world. I think it's And I, as you were speaking, I was thinking about the, you know, the damage it does, these kind of rigid hierarchies. You know, you scale it down to the abuse scandals, you know, where power is kind of so misused. But just the loneliness of being a priest in a parish and being isolated because you're carrying the world on your shoulders, but you're separate from the world because you're this special person. And it's very debilitating. It's very kind of a... It leads to an awful lot of problems, and that is the work you're doing, I think, is really changing kind of that model, which is damaging at many, many levels.
Yeah. There's certainly priests I know who are able to navigate these challenges and thrive and do it with a real love of people and a real deep sense of their calling. But I think for so many, they resort to clericalism as a poor substitute for the things that really could be part of their lives if they had these dispositions, as you're talking about them, this kind of way of being and relating. And I think Pope Francis sees it, and I think he also sees the effects of that, living with those poor substitutes, because the power imbalances, the abuses of privilege and perks, the attachments that kind of go along with all that, it's so unhealthy for everybody, including and probably most especially these priests.
Yeah, no, that's right. It isn't just kind of what they do to the other, it's what that does to them as well. And it's really, it's kind of not good. Do you think Pope Francis is from Argentina, right?
See.
And liberation theology was powerful in South America. What influence do you think that had on his thinking? I know he wasn't directly kind of a liberation theologist, but what do you think that impacted on his experience and his thinking? And his...
Well, you know, it's very complicated because the way in which liberation theology was done in the 70s and 80s was often very much influenced by socialism and communism to some degree.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say there's not tremendous liberation theology of a variety of types that really was rooted clearly in the gospel. Mm-hmm. The flavor that looked socialist or communist was, I think, more incidental and not the essential. But for Francis, the critical experience was accompaniment with regular people and especially the poor.
Yes.
So for him, living close to people who are poor, having a kind of working priest life, traveling on the metro with people, going to the partita, the soccer, the football matches, experiencing the life of the people kept him close to reality in a way that I think he sees many being separated. And this kind of closeness, I think, is something that he finds precious and transforming, because there's a joy there in the simplicity without idealizing or romanticizing poverty that he finds really powerful, very important, helping us to get back to the basics in a sense.
And like you say, being anchored into some kind of reality, it is interesting. My life, I don't know if I've told you, but I've gone through I was thrown out of school. I worked in a factory. I was a general nurse working with the sick and the dying. I kind of worked with psychiatric people, and I've been on this journey, and then you end up kind of, next week I'll be flying into a major bank in London, working with senior kind of people in the bank and in the corporate life, and in the places where people haven't experienced, the poverty and the simplicity of other lives. I do sense there's a kind of a void and a spiritual kind of poverty there. There is and a yearning, a real yearning for something, and for me, I have to be in touch with kind of otherness and social activists and people doing other things, and nature, unless you connect to these different things, then you do become, you do live in your own metaverse, to coin a phrase. there are these separate worlds, and they're impoverished worlds because you're disconnected from nature, from people, from working people, from different lifestyles.
It's true. I think that, you know, COVID has been so interesting because, okay, for certainly those who are super rich, they've been able to find their own ways of continuing to insulate themselves from that reality and from its oppressive effects, but not totally. And the longing for human connection the need for the experience of a kind of life of belonging and of interactivity. One of the beautiful things about the COVID experience, if I may say so, was spending so much time in nature. And I think that there are so many people who expressed very explicitly how healing that it prolonged sort of exposure to nature, being able to take long walks and be out with their dogs and wonderful, wonderful. So, you know, we know that what it takes to kind of warm our hearts at the end of the day, it doesn't have to be so expensive. And in fact, you know, if we live with a sort of sensible simplicity and are closer in our human relations and closer to nature, we know that that heals so many of the fundamental kind of divides that we experience in life today. I actually think that, you know, we're dished up an incredible opportunity with COVID, and unfortunately, we're not capitalizing on it in terms of the deeper transformation that could happen.
I agree. I wrote something. I actually made a podcast, and I called it "In Praise of the Flask," and it was like when COVID first came and lockdowns, and you couldn't go to your coffee shop, your regular routine, grab the cappuccino and meet some friends. And it was like, there's an emptiness, you know? And then I rediscovered filling up a flask of hot coffee and going to the hills. And I'd meet a friend like in a hill between our houses. And then we'd sit there with a flask and just the pleasure of being in nature and having this hot, warm drink and and rediscovering that was a real gift. It wasn't like you had to go to some major kind of a national park. Just on your doorstep, there'd be kind of park bits of nature and trees and to engage with is very, very beautiful.
When I first saw that title of that article, I actually thought, you meant like a flask of whiskey.
Yeah.
Just the way we think of it in the US, but we call it a thermos, Simon.
Yeah, okay. I'll have to retitle it in praise of the thermos. David, we could talk and talk. This is so interesting, and I really enjoyed this conversation, but we're coming to an end. I asked my guests, as you probably know, at the end of a session, what thoughts they might have on what it means to live a good life and to create the good society. And I wonder if you had any thoughts you'd like to share.
Gosh, I think we've been talking about them for the last hour, I would come back to that incredible gift of friendship. Experiencing friendships with no purpose is a beautiful thing. Experiencing friendships with purpose, with mission, so that the way we think about friendships at work, for instance, or in the important work that we do in our organizations for not just for the bottom line, but for some evolutionary purpose. That, I think, is just such a source of joy for me. I can only speak for myself. And I certainly hope that for those who are searching for that kind of thing, that they find it, because it's just hard to sort of supply that. I don't have my own family, my own children or spouse. So for me, finding the joy of that is really special, and I would say even sacred. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for me, I'd put a plug in for friendships with a mission.
That's lovely. Keep up your great work, David, and I hope to see you in Rome in a month or so. You
Fantastic. Take care. Thanks so much, Simon.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.